According to our next guest, never before has the court been more central in American life. It is the justices, rather than Congress or other elected officials, who decide the most controversial issues of our time, from abortion and gay marriage to campaign finance, gun control, and voting rights. Time and again, the justices intervene simply because they can, subverting self-government in the process. All of this according to our next guest, David Kaplan. He is the author of the new book, The Most Dangerous Branch, Inside the Supreme Court's Assault on the Constitution. Kaplan is the former legal affairs editor of Newsweek magazine, where he covered the Supreme Court for a decade. And we welcome David Kaplan to the roundtable this morning. David, thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Very nice to have you on the program. What brought you to make this argument of the Supreme Court the most dangerous branch?
Well, I've been writing about the court on and off for 25 years, so I guess the argument's probably been cooking. But I think it was the moment in 2016 when Justice Scalia suddenly died as the presidential campaign was gearing up, and you heard the Democrat and the Republican both agree the next justice could well determine key social policy in this country for 25 years or longer. And you heard other commentators chiming in. And I sort of said to myself, is that really the do you want a system where a single justice among nine unelected, unaccountable judges controls so much social policy? And it seemed to me that that orthodoxy among liberals and conservatives was wrong. So I wanted to explore it. And you do that in a book, not in a piece of journalism.
So in this book,
it is a hard argument to make because one finds that your audience confuses criticism of the court's role with individual decisions. So, you know, I talked to a majority of the justices. I talked to them on background. I can't say who I talked to or quote them. That's a condition for the interviews, understandably so. And I had one of the liberals and one of the conservatives both say to me, I half agree with you, because, of course, what the liberal thinks the court ought to stay away from decisions that the justice doesn't like, and vice versa with the conservative. And the problem is that that's got to do with outcome, not the role. So you have to be willing to say, as I am, for example, I support very liberal abortion laws, but I don't think those should be achieved at the court. You need to go across the street to Congress or to state legislatures to win that battle. And conservatives have to say, I support the right to own a handgun very freely, but you need to achieve those victories in legislatures, not in courts. And virtually everybody in the country isn't willing to say that.
You talk in the book about how you believe the court repeatedly overreaches and that they often issue rulings that run against popular opinion. I assume that is part of the job.
No, absolutely. I don't argue for an impotent court, and the court ought to be involved vindicating the rights of unpopular opinions and minority rights, because you can't expect Congress or state legislatures to look out for that. So, for example, we have a First Amendment that protects freedom of expression, and the reason we have that is because no legislator is going to vote to protect the speech rights of someone who's a communist or a white nationalist or in the Ku Klux Klan. You need a court which remains above the fray, removed from the commotion of politics. You need a court to protect that right. And same thing for the rights of criminal defendants, protections against unreasonable search and seizures, cruel and unusual punishments. But that does not mean that in other areas of policy, campaign finance regulation, in addition to gun control, same-sex marriage, abortion, it doesn't mean that those areas also should be within court control. And as I argue in the book, there are some areas the court does dodge, like partisan gerrymandering, the rigging of the shape of districts to keep the ins in power and to keep out the outs. And in that kind of area, where the court isn't picking winners and losers, Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, and liberals, but it's just setting the rules of the game. We want fair elections. In that one area, arguably, would have been the most important set of cases at the court in a generation. The court this past June stayed out of the issue and said it's not our job. That's for the political branches. So I think they get the balance totally wrong. And one of the consequences for that is not only distorting a presidential election. Many of Trump's supporters, polls showed, many of his supporters in 2016 couldn't stand him temperamentally or in terms of policy, but they said, listen, I think he's going to pick Supreme Court justices that I like, and that's going to be important for a generation, so I'll hold my nose and vote for him. Democrats felt almost the same way about Hillary, and I don't think presidential elections ought to be involved, about something more than that. You also see the distorting effect on the confirmation hearings of Brett Kavanaugh. Because the stakes are so high, both sides are willing to do what they've done. Republicans obstructed President Obama's choice of Merrick Garland in 2016, and the Democrats are doing what they're doing. Neither one is admirable. Both are entirely predictable, but I lay the blame chiefly not with the participants, but with the Supreme Court, because it is the court that makes a single seat on the court so important.
So let us talk about that, especially when it comes to Merrick Garland. How does that fall into the court's lap? I mean, that is, it seemed that that should have been, instead of that time spent in finding a justice at the tail end of the Obama administration, it was instead held up for the next president and taking a gamble, because obviously Hillary Clinton was expected by many political experts to be the winner of that contest. So I'm curious as to how that plays.
Well, I think Republicans obstructed in 2016 because a court vacancy is so important. I don't think they would have done so 20 or 40 years earlier. You behave that way, taking the risk that you're going to look politically cynical. You do that when you think it's worth the risk. And the Republicans knew, even though Hillary looked in the early 2016 like a far stronger candidate than any of the Republicans, and certainly Donald Trump, Republicans did it because the court is so important. In so many areas, the court runs the country. Now, it doesn't when it comes to war. The president can send troops to faraway lands. Congress can spend $1 trillion. It can pass foolish laws. It can do nothing all. I'm not arguing the other branches have no power. I'm only arguing that insidiously, in many areas, over the long term, it's the court that's engaged in a colossal power grab. They don't think of it that way. The justices, to a member, I think, operate in good faith. They are rarely thinking like naked partisans. They try to do a good job. But as Justice Brandeis argued 100 years ago, the most important thing that the court does is not doing. And that kind of humility, minimalism, judicial restraint in the truest sense, is something that's fallen out of fashion. And because it's fallen out of fashion, we get the Republican behavior with respect to Merrick Garland, which is what you asked about. We get distorted presidential elections and so forth.
So you did not call the book the most powerful branch. You call it the most dangerous branch. So where does the danger come in, given that power?
I think because it corrodes democracy. We have left, we these days in particular, of course, we don't have a lot of faith in our democracy. And if you look at a broken Congress and an often dysfunctional White House, there's reason not to have much faith in democracy. And it's really easy, instead of fighting out political battles at the state level and in Congress, it's easy to go to the courts to file a case. You might get a result on the lower court in a year. You might get a result in the Supreme Court in a few years. And that victory, if you get it, is lasting. A victory in the legislature can be overturned tomorrow. New election, new legislators, you just pass a different law. Once you reach a constitutional victory at the Supreme Court, you're pretty much set, short of the court overruling precedent, at which it doesn't do very often. You know, however controversial Roe v. Wade is, that victory was achieved in 1973, and it's still on the books. I understand why litigants want to win the victory in court instead. that are fighting it out in the popular branches of government, the way the framers intended, the way that democracy contemplates. I understand why people behave that way. What I criticize is the court accepting its role. And an undercurrent that I heard from some justices is that, of course, we have to step in. Just look around. They would point out the window over toward Congress or down Pennsylvania Avenue at the White House and say, nothing else works. Who but us to be the saviors for the nation? And that's understandable, but it's not good. And if you look at the Constitution, there is no clause that says anything along the lines of, if the other two branches of government ain't doing their jobs, it's up to the court. If the other two branches of government aren't doing their jobs, that's because we chose those branches, and I don't think we need to be saved from ourselves. If you want a change in policy, if you want Congress to start doing something, go to the ballot box and win the election. And, you know, I'm not an academic. I don't make this argument as a philosophical matter. I just ultimately would rather trust the people, such as they are, than nine unaccountable judges.
You talk about solutions in the book, and you mentioned term limits. How would that work?
Well, in order to, you might, for example, has been proposed, have an 18-year term limit, single term for a justice. And over time, once that system took place, you would stagger the terms so that every 2 years a president could nominate somebody. So that way, it wouldn't be a function of who's sick or who leaves for political reasons. It wouldn't be happenstance. It would be predictable. And I think that would lower the stakes. The last five justices who left the court, on average, served close to 30 years. It's become a geriatric profession. If it was only 18 years, I think you would lower the stakes. That said, it's never going to happen. It would require a constitutional amendment. They're hard to pass to begin with. And the party, if you will, in power, is never going to agree to that. The Democrats might embrace term limits now, but the Republicans who run the show would not do so any more than the Democrats would have endorsed it back when Obama and the Democrats were ascendant in 2009. I think the more likely change might be if the Democrats took control of the White House at both branches of Congress in 2021. I think it's possible they would try to pack the court. Now, FDR proposed that in 1937. It was universally criticized. It went nowhere. But I think it is possible that the Democrats, if hyperpartisanship continues, if they are sufficiently enraged and motivated, what goes on in the Supreme Court the next couple of years, they could try to add two seats to the Supreme Court, make it an 11-member tribunal, and appoint two Democrats, two justices who would skew liberal, and that way they would be, quote-unquote, the winner. And to change the size of the court, all you need to do is pass an act of Congress. It does not require a constitutional limit. Do I think that's likely? No, but I think it's conceivable. Of course, what then happens the next time the Republicans win? Well, if the court is still in Democratic control, Republicans could say, let's increase the size of the court again. At some point, that's what politicization of the court leads to. I think that's a bad outcome, but I think it's possible. And if you got to that kind of extreme, and Democrats are talking about it now, then you sort of ask the question, why do we have the court? You and I talked a little bit about you need the court to vindicate some constitutional rights, like First Amendment or Fourth Amendment prohibition against search and seizures. But at some point, if the court is viewed just as another political branch, a super legislature, why bother having it? That's not why the Constitution set up the court. It's not why we had it historically. They've issued controversial rulings in their history, surely. Dred Scott helped produce the Civil War. But what's gone on the last 50 years, I argue in the book, is new and it's different. And if you tune in and listen to the confirmation hearings, you don't really hear any senator ask, what's the proper role of the court? When should you not get involved at all? Instead, you hear them debating about abortion, gun control, same-sex marriage, presidential power, what happens if Trump does this or that. And I guess I'd like to see some senator, be most likely a Democrat, because the Republicans don't want to ask anything. They would just assume adjourn the whole thing and vote. I'd like to see somebody ask Brett Kavanaugh, without commenting on a specific area of social policy, which you're not going to talk about, tell me what the role of the court is. Look over the 200-plus year history of the court, and can you point to periods of time where you thought the court did well by staying out of the fray? Nobody asks that question anymore. It's quite remarkable.
We talk about solutions to the problem. We've mentioned constitutional amendments and, of course, changes in party. But obviously, the easiest solution would be that a president and the Senate think of nominating someone who is deferential and fair and more balanced.
Well, I think certainly, ideally, one could hope for a different president and different senators believing that judicial restraint in the truest sense, deference, a more minimalist court would be a good idea. But that ain't going to happen. It didn't happen under President Obama, although I think he had some of those instincts. But that's not why he chose Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor. Certainly the current president didn't pick Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh for that reason. And I don't think there's a reason to believe that kind of sea change is going to take place. No, I think the best hope for the court, and it's a small hope, I'm not optimistic, is that the court itself, for self-preservation, will understand that more important than achieving this or that outcome in campaign finance or voting rights, that maybe some members of the court will want to pull the reins on its aggressiveness. I think the best hope for the court is actually Chief Justice Roberts. To be sure, a conservative. Don't mistake him for moderate. Don't think he's Anthony Kennedy, who sort of passed for a moderate at the court. But Chief Justice, assuming Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed, the new swing justice is really going to be John Roberts. He's going to have four liberal justices to the left, and he's going to have four conservative justices to the right. And while he's going to be with the conservatives much of the time, and he's certainly with them in sentiment, I think it is possible that this Chief Justice, as chief and with great reverence for the institution's history and traditions, might in some cases say, no, I don't want the court in the middle of the storm by issuing, for example, overturning Roe v. Wade or stepping into the fray on all range of policy issues that will come before. Now, he did that in 2012 in the Obamacare case, his shining moment, I argue in the book. Not because I think Obamacare was a good law, I happen to think it is, but because he said it's not our job to be overturning an act of Congress. It's probably constitutional, maybe it's a close case, but better to leave it to the people, to their representatives, to be making decisions, all the more so, although he didn't argue this in the case, all the more so in the year of a presidential election. Because if they had overturned Obamacare, a huge issue in the presidential race, perhaps more so than in 2016 as it turned out, would have been the Supreme Court. And I think Roberts understood that is bad for the institution. It weakens the court's prestige for when it's really needed, like in the case Brown v. Board of Education, where it outlawed segregation in public schools, or like in Nixon, United States v. Nixon, the tapes case during Nixon's reign in 1974. And I think Roberts might follow that instinct again, but he might not. I mean, it is really important to him to deregulate campaign finance even more than it is now, even if it results in more money being thrown into politics. I think he wants to dismantle the Voting Rights Act even more so. He doesn't believe that racial preferences in admissions and employment and so forth should be used. So he he's a diehard conservative. I think it's possible he would recognize damage to the court and, in turn, the damage done to other institutions. He more than any of the other conservatives, Sam Alito, Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch. I think he holds that possibility, and he has the institutional advantage of being Chief Justice.
The name of the book, The Most Dangerous Branch Inside the Supreme Court's Assault on the Constitution. The book is published by Crown. David Kaplan is the author. David, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, The Most Dangerous Branch. David Kaplan is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.